Hello and welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton, and with me today is just Duncan.
Just me. Just a little old me.
Especially Duncan.
Yeah.
Well, counting on from last episode where we talked about the Akira movie and manga, we thought that we were going to do a more general sci-fi topic. One of the things we mentioned when talking about Akira, the manga versus the anime, is how they had such different ideas of what a cityscape looked like. Not just in the manga later, where there's a substantial amount of destruction that causes necessary social adjustment, but simply the fact that these scenes of people rioting in the streets and a tottering government versus like the largely empty urban wasteland of Otomo's manga. And I kind of just wanted to focus on visions of futuristic urban living, what different anime and manga, if we feel like it, see as the experience of living there. What are the characteristics? What are the obvious fixations that we see with these future cities? And yeah, I watched a lot of crap, pejorative, for this this topic. Every bad OVA I skipped over when I was coming up. I watched a ton of them. I also watched Cyberpunk Edgerunners and had a good time, although that's fucking depressing in its own way. So yeah. I don't know. How did you approach this? How did you approach this topic, Duncan?
This is very much, as you say, one of those topics where we have come off one particular work and it has lit a fire underneath us to investigate something else. Mm-hmm. In my case, it was very much me getting punted directly from Akira to Konikotsky. And its particular sort of place in the wider Gaia theory and cybernetics, as in biology rather than as in metal bits strapped onto a person. The interesting thing about cities and just societies is in works like this is whether or not they are set dressing or whether or not they are actually something which fuels the drama themselves. And I think a lot of times when people talk about world building, they're talking about people filling out a world, like just putting in details just to make it feel lived in.
Mm-hmm.
That's good, but that also is, to me, kind of the bare minimum. I kind of want a story to stem from its world, it to feel like it's inevitable, this is the way the story plays out. Never feeling like there's this disconnect between what the story that we're being told and the way that the society supposedly is. Like,
I'm reading between the lines of what you're saying, and like, I can't wait to revisit like Lycoris Recoil. I should have rewatched it. Anyway, keep going.
If you were going to rewatch it, you should have just rewatched the miniseries Friends of the Thieves of yes. Time, and then you'd got all the
Friends
good stuff.
Friends are Thieves of Time.
Yeah. I'm going to go non-sci-fi for a second, but like there's a quite a famous and quite misquoted line from the eponymous Chinatown, where Jake's like having a conversation with someone, and it's Chinatown.
Forget it, Jake.
Yeah, we've seen enough of the way the system works by that point. But when we hear that, it's self-evident. It's, yeah, of course, that's how it works. Strangely, one of the things where. And I do think it is, to an extent, consciously aping in that genre is cyberpunk. Edgerunners did a very good mm-hmm. job of having a city and characters who felt like that the characters existed because of the city and their lives played out the way they were always destined to. I think one of the reasons noir stuff and pulp stuff has gone very well into sort of modern, sort of, I'm not sure if you'd call it, it's not quite contemporary sci-fi, but it's near futurism.
Yeah, near future sci-fi.
There's this idea that these megacorps and these surveillance states, these systems which are too big to be changed by any individual actor, create the same sense of inevitability, which I think the sort of underworlds and the corrupt police, etc., do in traditional noir. There's always a sense that the system is going to grind you down and spit you out.
Yeah, one of the things that really struck me as I did a bunch of watching and rewatching, and I'm glad I went back to, I think it's episode 143, Airplane Legs, where we talk about military, especially even like near future military. Mm-hmm. And what really struck me is there we really had to make our own decision about where does the military end and militarized police begin? And we
focused
on the former. And now to look at the latter, I'm shocked how much of people's vision in anime of future society is just – there's some exceptions like Time of Eve and Serial Experiments Lane where you have this kind of just like living in this like highly digital society that's going through social changes. But generally – and even like Genkutsuo when it kind of reinvents the Count of Monte Cristo, that also is more concerned with like the actual like – political and social life of living in a futuristic city or a city planet named Paris.
You've given me an excuse to rewatch Gantuk, so
I have a little mini anime club, and I'm campaigning for that. So like, and they're like, oh, we've seen the Count of Monte Cristo, and I'm like, no, I mean, yes, but it's good. It's a work of art. But to the point of like Akka, AD Police, Bubblegum Crisis, Dominion Tank Police, Ghost in the Shell, Jinro. There's all – it's so much how like life in these futuristic cities is just a matter of like extreme hyper policing with violent cops and this idea that like the act of trying to control an urban society becomes so overwhelming that it becomes the main way that people interact with their fellow person. And one of the things I really dreaded about when I was putting off watching Cyberpunk Edgerunners for months and years is I was really worried it was going to be a crime story about just like fighting the cops and eventually you lose. And it was kind of a pleasant surprise that it's more of an addict story. It's a story about this like poor Latino kid living in LA who gets hooked on drugs / cybernetics and just like eventually overdoses. And like the way that he overdoses is by, you know, taking so many immunosuppressants that his brain melts, and then he fights a guy who's all robot, which it's whatever. But I enjoyed the idea that it wasn't about crime and criminals and like shootouts with the cops. It was more just about like how this city sucks to live in, and so you take drugs or trick out your body, two things that are essentially fulfilling the same role, to kind of deal with it. And of course you have to keep doing heists to pay for all your cool chrome. That's the only way that you're able to stand to live in this atomized society full of debt and assholes and violence. And it meant that it was higher up on the list than, you know, something that's just like fucking Megazone 23. Oh my god, like y'all have been dealing with me watching those and complaining, but what an overrated series of OVAs.
Yeah, Edgerunners being this kind of as the train spotting cyberpunk train spotting is I think definitely a read I can take, because I do think like there is this idea that when you have a system which sort of deprives you of power, you will look elsewhere for ways of trying to escape. Like if you cannot literally escape, you will mentally escape, or you will pharmacologically or cybernetically escape, whichever way you can. Because I am a terrible pragmatist, Ben. It is a very good thing that I'm not a political leader, because I would probably just end up a faceless bureaucrat. Because I always underestimate the need that people have for just hope. Not for we're dealing with what we have to deal with day to day, but for the idea that things could get better. I think part of what is interesting about the cyberpunk setting, is it 2060? What is it? What's the specific name of the setting? It's 2060?
2070. Well, every time they changed the edition of the role-playing game for Cyberpunk, they would bump year up.
I like that.
So 2077 is, I think, the current. No, it's good. Yeah, but...
But I think one of the things I like about that is that you've got this idea that the net itself has become fragmented, because both you and I are old enough to remember the early days of the internet as a sort of a mass media. like people all like wondering what its potentiality could be, like this almost new way of ordering ourselves, of this new system where different things would have different priorities. Because I think, not to go a bit Jeff, but like...
Why not?
This is a saying that I can't remember. You'll tell me who it's a misquote of. Like, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism.
It's so garbled, but
I think the reason why that's spread is because there is a certain truth to it. And I think that's because, like, from the viewpoint of one human, the way that capitalism has overlaid itself on every aspect of a person's life, it can feel like that. And you look at something, it has a price on it. You know what it will cost you to replace it if it breaks. Mm-hmm. You everything has a value. And I think when the internet first emerged, there was a sense of, in the more utopian visions of it, like this could be a technology which breaks that. Mm-hmm. Knowledge wants to be free, I think, was one of the buzz phrases.
Can't stop the signal, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And that the fact that cyberpunk explicitly goes, okay, then not just has that more utopian world overlay failed, it's become so fragmented and so territorially controlled by corporations that instead of this alternate overlay slowly replacing the sort of capitalist overlay we impose on our society, that has gone into cyberspace and imposed itself on that. Mm-hmm. Capitalism and the way the world is ordered now has become even more inescapable in cyberpunk than it is in our current day-to-days. And that's one of the ways science fiction really works well, in that it creates environments where you can run something to its logical conclusion, and
right,
whether that's a dystopian conclusion or a utopian conclusion, you can still just keep running that thing until you hit point where the system sort of hits stasis and just feels like it is self-sustaining. And later we'll talk a bit about Ghost in a Shell, and there's some things in that which I think reflect Gaia theory, which is sort of early environmental theory, which positions the world as kind of like a self-regulating network. Mm-hmm. There's a feedback system where life changes the world in ways which it makes it more likely for life to persist and so on. One of the things a lot of these systems have is this idea of like a steersman, like this entity where it can self-correct, the self-correcting part of the system. Whenever the system goes out of balance, this element steps in and pushes the system back towards equilibrium. And in a strange way, I think one of the reasons that the police are so ubiquitous in future sci-fi is because that's the role they play. They are the role which pushes anyone who threatens to break out of the system back to the median, to round any edges off, to flatten everything.
Yeah, we were talking about this a little bit with the contrasting of like Ghost in the Shell and kind of the like transcendent thing versus Akira, and this kind of like this like collapsing transcendence versus like scaffolding transcendence. And I do think that it is interesting how these Malthusian concerns are really shot through. And sure, that's like led the legacy of the population bomb in the 70s, and this idea that as society grows in wealth and sophistication and population, it's going to outrun our ability to actually organize society. And so half seriously, you see this in a lot of like Masamune Shirow's work, like especially Dominion Tank Police. I think people wilding out over how great the new Ghost in the Shell is, they should really treat themselves to watching Dominion Tank Police, which is just the exact same sense of humor, except it's got tanks instead of cybernetics and faux Buddhist thinking. But this idea that just like all the systems are going to run away in every direction. Therefore, the police become the most relevant part of society. Like all major human activity is going to move onto the net or move into like cybernetic direct connections. And therefore, like laws and policies and basic income programs and environmental regulations will all fall aside. It will just be the thin blue line between us and just colony collapse. Honeybees, yeah. Style. And it's funny because like all those worries about the honeybees dying were part of that like pseudo-Malthusian paranoia, and the answer was less polluting. Like that's really like we like the honeybees are no longer like wild ones are still fucked because you know we can't stop polluting, but like domesticated bees, like those colonies are all recovering because it was just simply that we did not realize how much we were destroying this world ecosystem, and the assumption that it was coming for it came for the natural world, and eventually it'll come for humans in the built world.
People being like, they keep sending us these defective canaries. Why do they keep dropping dead? They're like, our coal mine's fine, but the canaries keep dying. Like, why? This seems so strange.
Yeah, but the way that spills over into visions of like urban sci-fi landscapes where there isn't this, you know, like budding. Like I was thinking about the Magical Index and Scientific Railgun, where it's just this like futuristic, like new city, and we see this a lot, like even whether it's like post-apocalyptic like Ergo Proxy or just like it's just a place where things happen like Gridman Universe, this idea of just this hyper advanced society where like most like public activity is built around policing, and like then we can like go from there into like Horus Recoil, where it's like, oh, secret murder police is allowing us to have this like beautiful futuristic city, except also kind of still yes. So
it's Yuri Judge Dredd, basically.
That's real good.
Watching Licorice Recoil is both a joy and a deep disappointment in that it, moment to moment...
There's our title.
Moment to moment, it has a wonderful chemistry between its cast, and they're all very well VA'd, but God, what a dogshit plot. I think one of the things which is one of the cheapest, most bullshit ways that someone can try and write their way out of, I've got a big idea, but I can't be fucking asked writing the systemic implications of this, is, well, what if that big thing was a secret, Ben? What if not everyone knew about it? And so it didn't actually affect anyone. And so it was just this secret society doing secret things. And we have this hermetically sealed little system ticking away in the background. And you've got the Yuri judges going around murking people just because they might do something wrong. You've got the Minority Report computer just there going, yeah, I see the future. We can send you to this guy who's about to do something because he happens to have bought, I don't know, a comic with a bit too much action.
Plastic explosives, ingredients or anything else.
Yeah, or whatever. But it's... I think they actually make it worse by having their bad guy's whole thing being like, I'm going to be the guy who breaks this, the way that society is run, out into the open. And having him constantly saying that makes you go, okay, how come no one has fucking noticed any of this already? Like, it's like, I think you're just really overestimating the ability of bureaucrats to keep a secret, because there have been so many laptops left on trains and lovers told all things that, like, these things get out. Like,
no, people are sheep, Duncan. People will walk by a corpse on the sidewalk and not even care. Like, that's honestly a lot of what underpins like Horus Recoil's idea, is just that like there are a bunch of NPCs and then there's a handful of real people who are actually like doing things.
Yeah, it's just so frustrating. Like, oh, so it's like, oh, the Licorice are the little girl assassins, and there's the little boy assassins as well. And okay, I can see what you're doing. This you've implied one thing, but they don't imply the other thing, which is where the fuck are the adult? Like, where are the adult assassins? Surely, like, just the attrition so high on Licorice that none of them actually make it to adulthood. It's like, forget.
I think they become instructors, I think is what's implied, but yeah, there's not a lot of them visually physically present in the story.
I don't know,
that touches on something else, is the child soldier angle that like every anime has to find, that wants to be about child soldiers has to find a reason to have. And like I've always just preferred Evangelions, just like, yeah, you have to be 14 because that's when your emotions are the most fucked up. So they allow you to connect to the Eva. But like, why is it little girls? Is it? And I think the suggestion is just because that's, no one would suspect that, which is not not a great idea to it's like we should make all of our policing forces the most underdeveloped and emotionally unstable stage of human human life.
Good idea.
Because they're easier to brainwash that way, I guess, is the actual answer. But there is this, you know, even in like Darling in the Franxx or
86, any number of shows, yeah, where it's like, oh, our child soldiers, etc., etc.
Simone.
Actually, that's something my memory of Simone is so vague. Like when you talked about that in one of our previous shows, you mentioned the idea like there's this one central like spring where which is like central to their society because it's the one thing which allows people to sort of pick a gender, and like wars are fought over this thing. And as much as it may be like a stupid, not stupid, let's not call it stupid, as much as it may be quite a contrived premise, like they have at least gone, okay, so we want this strange society, and so what becomes like valuable in that, then the world becomes the world it is. And it's rare to think of a city where it's an implication of a particular big idea which worked well. I sort of wish it hadn't turned out to be a horrible den of child torture, because Made in Abyss does at least have an interesting angle on sort of like this civilization based around this sort of hole to the center of the earth of where all the good tech lives, and all the implications of that are interesting. But I just don't want to put up with the stuff I have to, appropriately enough, don't want to have to put up with the shit I'd have to go through to get there. But
yeah, it's unfortunately
what you talking about, the sort of one of the Megazone stories made me think of Battle Angel Alita and the floating city in that, and how I think that's one of those things where someone had the idea of the visual thing first, of this junkyard with this gleaming city hanging over it, and like this idea of the poor and the rich, and that was for like a couple of volumes just living on vibe. But at some point he decided, okay, this city can't just be this point to aim for, this symbol of aspiration which was out of their reach, and it would almost automatically crush their dreams, like just by the way it had ordered their society. People were forced to act in horrific ways. It just perpetuated its status without actually trying. As he wrote more volumes, he obviously wanted it to have more of a... People started to wonder, okay, what if someone got up there? What would that mean? What is up there? And he had to write this entire sort of secondary explanation for what the society of that city was like. And he sort of comes up with a post hoc explanation for the city he had already created. I wonder if any of the cities in your lists are similar to that for you, are sort of post hoc explanations. Someone's had a cool city idea and then they've had to sort of come up with an explanation for it.
Yes, I don't see quite so bright a dividing line there, is that oftentimes works come from a specific kernel and then kind of get built out around.
True.
I think that this is going to be a left field one, but like Aria, where they're living on this kind of recreated Venice on Mars, and that is definitely like, I want to have like a futuristic Venice, and then from there you kind of build out like, well, it's on Mars and people like voluntarily immigrate and they have a very strict guild system to make sure that kind of keeps technological development in check. That one is interesting because it does seem to be a bit more of an abjuration of technological progress, while still obviously like being in the future, there's spaceships and there's interplanetary communication.
Yeah, Aria's an interesting one because, as you say, someone's just gone, there's canals on Mars, and okay, so what if there's a Venice on Mars, and so what would life be like on that? Why would you choose to live on a canal in Mars? Like, what is the sort of person who wants to live on that sort of place, and like, what, how is that going to be a sort of very different life to the sort of life everyone else chooses to live? Is it what sort of person does that life attract? And so that is very much growing from a seed and in sort of unpredictable directions, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And like the other ones are just like, I don't know, like the Big O takes place in like a futuristic city. And that was literally meant to just be kind of vibes until Cartoon Network pushed them to make another season. Mm. And the prerequisites were more fights and there has to be an ending that like explains everything. And I'm a much bigger fan of the first core of Big O than the second core. But it is funny how we kind of get this like dark city, but it's all on the net and actually it's all inside a computer, yada, yada. I don't feel like that's actually spoiling it because I think Big O has actually kind of a bad ending all told. But just because it's forced to explain something that was entirely these vibes of this like futuristic noir city where no one has any memory. But often this idea that like this kind of reaches back to what we were talking about with these kind of like Malthusian runaway technology and how the police are often deployed to be a counterweight to that. There is this often this vision that like everything's moving on to the net and the city is kind of just the booster rocket that will be left behind. Like everything from Serial Experiments Lane where the Wired is what's really happening. Megazone also has this sort of thing where like everything important in the third episode, which people don't like, but I thought was honestly the most coherent. It was dumb, but it was like the most plot coherent. It wasn't like the first episode, which was cut together from a canceled series and makes no sense for most of it. But this idea that like there are these like warring networks and whichever one wins will just become the default reality that's laid all over everything. And even when it's not as sinister as that, we have something like Denocoil where it is just like AR is literally walls and buildings and locations are being built in AR instead of in the real world. And that kind of this idea that we're evolving past the internet makes the entire world one big city. It's almost that Gaia thing you're talking about. And therefore, like the need to actually live in urban environments is not quite as necessary. And I don't know. I think about Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri, not an anime, but the greatest game ever made, but also has this idea of like a you know, dense human life becomes a neural network with the power of the internet and therefore becomes a like meta life form. And it's neat to see that as one of the elements, the other being like the last city on Earth, which I was talking about with Ergo Proxy or Blame, these like domed mega cities that are just all of human life. People no longer live out in the country. People just all live in this human hive, again, gesturing to like, you know, bee colonies and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, like you've also got things like Girls Last Tour where there's almost...
Oh, yeah.
Where as the way you described like humanity moving, or at least the parts of humanity which quote unquote matter to a society moving up to sort of disconnecting itself with the sort of physical and sort of leaving behind this sort of shell society in its wake, and like there's a sense that in Girls Last Tour this is a society which has created this mega structure and we have no idea why it created this mega city or how it sustained itself for a while, but there's just people left in the ruins of it, and it's interesting because it's a future city without cops, and the reason you don't have cops is because there's no system left to protect. There's no society to be dragged back to equilibrium. This is thrown so far out of balance that cops would be meaningless, and so it is all about whether or not people can sort of make a, not even a society, but even just a lifetime in what remains of this. Like, is it possible to just exist, or has society atrophied to such a point that it's impossible to exist? Because, like, I think a city must, for all as harsh an environment as something like all these mega cities seem, they still have to sustain their inhabitants. Because the moment they stop sustaining the people who inhabit them, they become these shells. And I think one quite interesting sort of entry to all this was Decadence, which was a show a few years back. And that because that's interesting in that you kind of the controlling part of society essentially had become digital. Like you have these two sort of parallel societies. You have the real people, quote unquote, and you have these AIs living up in this virtual city. And this virtual society comes as tourists to this physical society. And like that sort of inversion of it, and like the inevitable human movement to the net, instead of it ending at the point where the net has become so divorced from us that it then sort of comes back down to us, was quite a different take, and one I enjoyed. I think we sort of talked around Ghost in the Shell and its most recent incarnation and its most recent plotline. As we speak, it's making its way through the Puppet Master plotline, and you mentioned earlier like the Major's sort of direct encounter with the Puppet Master and this idea of a kind of transcendence and like how it's sort of depicted as almost angelic. I think to me that reads really strongly as Gaia theory.
Yeah.
This idea that cyberspace is like this proxy reality we have created, and this again, like this overlay, and once a being reaches a certain level of knowledge within that, that overlay sort of become with reality sort of becomes permeable to it. We've talked a little bit about what a ghost could mean in Ghost in the Shell and how different adaptations have different levels of how strict they are about its definition. And the idea of a ghost, I think, does influence, as you say, does influence those cities and does influence the police as well. And I think the Puppet Master arc is an important one because the idea of a ghost needs a counterexample, like that you can, as a human, that you can move from your physical existence to the net, and that some part of you, which is still truly you, can exist on the net. That's sort of what a ghost means, and that's seen as separate to any sort of artificial intelligence. But for that to exist, you kind of like need to have a ghost come the other way. You need to have something come from the artificial net to our reality. You have to see something come the other way through that membrane. And I feel like the Puppet Master arc is about sort of establishing where that borderline is and that things can cross the other way. And I think like that, once you have that established and you have a better idea of like, okay, like this is, ghosts are kind of like us on one layer and the net is another layer, and that it's not necessarily, and that's how you travel back and forth is I think how it sort of suggests how its dystopia might eventually become something else.
A lot of hay is often made about how different Ghost in the Shell standalone complex is from the more like mainline Shiro influenced Ghost in the Shell movies and this new one. But the thing that they both have that kind of unites is that like this is the process of discovering that there is a new unique characteristic of humanity. Mm-hmm. And as a boring, stodgy person, I like it better in Ghost in the Shell standalone complex, where the ghost is just something that's created by humans interacting with the net, and therefore the Puppet Master is this alarming thing where a non-human system is creating a ghost. But even in the Shiro definition, where ghosts are just emergent results of extreme concentrations of data, and it just so happens that the only force in reality able to concentrate data and create hyper-complex systems to such a degree is humanity, and that like the density of our neurons, the sizes of our brains are the one natural instance of this hyper compression of super complex systems that creates this sort of quasi pseudo soul that in turn allows the net to be something more than just fancy telephones. And I do enjoy that. I'm liking the new Ghost in the Shell fair enough. I don't really dig the irreverence like everyone else seems to, but don't know, whatever makes people happy. But I do like that it does seem to have, I mean, all the Ghosts in the Shell, and, you know, Pat Labor also in benefits this despite being stories of riot cops, futuristic riot cops. It is a story of like how society is ordering itself, and it's the second unit of Pat Labor and the Section 9 are both these kind of part of the system but standing outside the system, where they can observe, you know, in Ghost in the Shell, how the world is putting itself back together after a succession of world wars, and with Pat Labor, how it's handling the fact that all heavy industry is being taken over by the robotics industry, and how that's allowing the construction of our colleges and the mass reshaping of the planet. I think it is interesting that when sci-fi says that that humans have not fully learned ourselves, because I think it's very tempting to like treat humans as a solved problem and have the exoticness of sci-fi be exogenous. But we don't know how the human brain works. And so like venturing this sort of thing in Ghost in the Shell is interesting. Like, we don't know the mechanisms by which antidepressants operate. We know they work.
Yep.
And it's always scary for anyone who's on an antidepressant when just suddenly you wake up one day and Wellbutrin isn't causing those neurotransmitters to fire in the same way. And so to kind of sci-fi-itize that frontier keeps, I think, those shows from having the nihilism of just the idea that we're going to turn the Earth into one big city and then it will have to be a police state because there's just so many people, and people are evil, and decay and corruption are our nature.
I think partly why people are like, partly why we have an irreverence Ghost in the Shell, and partly why people are liking an irreverent Ghost in the Shell, is because we're living in a time where the sort of more utopian or hopeful message would be kind of just shot down. It would kind of just be seen as, for lack of a way to put it. Like, we live in a very cynical time that people cannot see a way out of the way things are heading, and that they don't feel like it's heading in a good direction. And so the very human way to react to that is to laugh. It's to just go, well, what the fuck? This is absurd. And that absurdity, I think, is what people latch onto and like about it, because it allows you to look at this world, which is has exaggerated characteristics of our own, and to not sort of. I don't know if this is a daft way of putting it, Ben, but I feel like worrying is a luxury. Like, to watch a film or a story or read a book or whatever, to be able to worry about the story you're being told and the way that narrative depicts the future means your current life is probably not as bad as that. Whereas if you're reading a book and you're going, okay, this future world really sucks, and it seems inevitable, and it seems inevitable because your current world sucks as well, then there's no sort of time to worry or to all you can sort of do is laugh in the face of it, because there's no other, you can't fight it, and there you can't run from it, and so you just have to. Well, maybe that is our ghost, Ben. Maybe laughter is our ghost. Like, maybe the ability to just laugh at a seemingly hopeless situation and pick ourselves up and go again is somehow remarkable in its own way.
Yeah, I mean, evolutionary psychology is largely bunk, but I always enjoy the theories of how, like, laughter makes us able to. It's become a pleasure mechanism, but the suggestion that it's the way that we handle like unexpected, impossible or absurd situations is like, I don't know, it's kind of similar to how like we smile as a sign of social like social bonding, but for every other species on the planet, showing your teeth is a is a threat. But for humans, it's a way to be like, hey, I'm nice, I'm friendly, as we flash our canines. And I don't know. It's I was thinking about that because someone was talking about how often people will get attacked by chimpanzees because they see them smiling and they're like, oh, hey, we're friends. And the chimpanzee's like, I'm going to rip out your fucking throat. And so, yeah, like, I guess that goes back to the same sort of, like, the fact that, like, there's something emergent about humanity that we can't quite quantify yet, and that, like, the excitement of these of budding technology and these, like, increasingly sophisticated urban structures are kind of providing a test bed for that. Do we have any closing comments? Want to wrap it up?
I was just thinking.
Any shows you really want to bring up? I watched Promare, and that one's just,
oh dear.
What if firefighters were cops? it's really all it asks. But
your remark about Sid Meier's Office in Theory earlier made me sort of think, like, the way that we have often chose to gamify cities is often in city builders. Like, there's obviously, like, how can I make the system as efficient as possible? And the one thing which often, like, they almost come down to is your transport. Like, it's your transport mm-hmm. networks. Public transit is not necessarily something which often comes up as a subject for what we're going to base this science fiction on, because it's kind of taken for granted, but it is often the thing which, just like communication, is like how goods get to different areas, how people get to different areas, how we communicate for a long, long time. And like, it's so rare to see it play any real form in any sort of city. And like, one of the few things I could think of was Doom Train, where you have like this idea that after a sort of, like, their whole 7G or 6G, I can't remember, this they create a form of magical,
I think it's 7G,
yeah, let's call it 7G, it'll do. They switch on this form of sort of technological broadcasting, and it warps the world in sort of undescribable ways to a way it makes sense. And the only sort of bit of sanity left in all this sort of madness is this transit, like this train running from A to B. It's this anchor which everything else is based around. And in a weird way, like, that society has just fallen apart, and the only thing left is its transit, and there's nothing.
Right. What is the seed at the core of urban living? And is it the cops? Is it the trains? Yeah. Is it like electricity and computers and technology? Mm. Yeah.
The other thing is that I thought of was I can't think of many sort of big shows where there's sort of been like anything around commerce in a city. Like the idea of, okay, I've moved to this mega city and I'm now, like, there's so many stories. Like, it's weird. Like, it. One of the most common tropes in isekai seems to be, I've come to this new world, I'm now going to make it big in fantasy land with my new shop selling this thing. But there's never I've made it to the big city, the megacorp, and now I'm going to set up my little shop which is going to sell whatever. Like, it feels like maybe it's just because that's such a humdrum idea. Like, the closest thing we get is Apocalypse Hotel, where the city's already been hollowed out, and it's just a single building, and how a community slowly forms around that until the whole world is an extension of the hotel. And it does feel like the idea of how a person's job links them to a city is kind of underrepresented.
Yeah, people kind of just have laptop jobs in the future, it really seems. Yeah. like no one like, you're either a construction worker, a cop, or you're an office worker, which maybe is just a reflection of Japan. But
you can be a bin man. You can be a garbage man.
You can be a garbage man, but then you just get brainwashed.
Yeah. Probably why you don't want to be a garbage man.
Cool. Well, let's go ahead and wrap it up there. When we come back, we'll be talking about a couple of shows we've been watching from this airing season. Plus, maybe I'll talk about Crest of the Stars a bit. I wanna fly. back. To start out with, Duncan is going to talk about one of the shows that he's watching and I'm not, although he's tried his best to make to make me watch
There's a lot of shows I'm watching and you're not, to be frank, Ben. Like,
I know, I know. I have Goodbye Lara on my hard drive. I'll watch it eventually, presumably.
I mean, like, if we're just going on what has been living rent-free in Duncan's mind for, like, the past X number of weeks, then I would be talking Sayonara Lara, which is one of those rare occasions where I default to the Japanese title just because of the cadence. Sayonara Lara. Yes, we have to go with that.
Yeah. Like when I try to explain the joke of Space Patrol Luluko, where it's Patrol Ruruko.
Oh dear.
Those people and their puns. Anyway.
Yeah, so Dara-san of the Reiwa era is definitely a show made by people who like their puns. Like, yeah, it's part sort of tale of how folklore evolves in relation to the people and location that is created, and part tale of two kids meeting big tiddied naga aunt and deciding to hang out with her. It is that very Japanese combination of sort of the grotesque and the ridiculous. So the plot of the show is that in this small village in the sort of Japanese hinterlands, there's this legend of a giant snake monster, which if you go into certain areas, you'll be devoured by it. It's called the Yamatagi Madara, and it's like this big entity to be feared, and like... There's a shrine dedicated to it on the outskirts of the town. During a storm, the fence around that shrine gets blown down, and two kids, Karu and Hinata, go out there to investigate the area they've always been told to stay away from. And when they get there, they meet this terrifying naga lady, and essentially she's like, "I'm the guardian of this shrine. Why have you disturbed me?" And they're like, we were just curious. We just wanted to know what's going on here."
We were just trammeling where we shouldn't be.
Yeah. And she's like, "Do you not know? Are you not scared of me?" And they're like, "No, not really." Like, the whole sort of start of it is she's like, "I'm the Yamatagi Madara." And they're like, "Oh, that's too long to say, so we'll just call you Dara-san." and the whole sort of point where this story turns on is this idea that in naming a thing differently, you change the nature of the thing. And so by treating her as Dara-san rather than the Yamatagi Madara, they change the nature of her. Like, the Dara-san is kind of like this an amalgamation of a priestess and this yokai she tried to banish. There's this whole bloody and quite traumatic backstory. You can tell it's told in blocks, which kind of fit the cadence of the manga, where you have two little mini stories per episode, if that makes sense. You know how every little mini arc starts with a flashback to the early times when the legend was formed, and then we get told a little bit about the Yamatagi Madara and about the woman who Dara-san originally was, and how that after her death, this legend changed and was passed down amongst the townsfolk in different ways, and how their relationships with her influenced the way that this legend was passed down and the practices they took on. It has this feeling of a mythology which isn't static, one which has evolved in relation to the people who are retelling it. And because of that, I think it actually feels more believable than many sort of little mythologies I've run into, because they're often so monolithic and so unchanging. How often is a mythology in any fantasy thing just something made up because someone needs a god to call upon, rather than something where this one time we did the sacrifice slightly different, so this bit changed, or what was once secret knowledge has become commonplace, and what was once commonplace has become secret. It sort of does that through the lens of the two kids, and I'd say they're basically occult otakus in a way. They're otakus in general, but their new special interest is cool snake lady aunt, and therefore they want to know everything about her. But equally, they want to show her all the things that she doesn't know about the current world. And so you're shown that she was very agile with her hands when she was alive, and that she used that to sort of draw these mystical signs. And that one of the kids is like, "Oh yeah, I draw manga as a hobby. You should start drawing as well." And she's like, "Oh yeah, I actually have really good hand-eye coordination. And in fact, I've got six hands. aunt. Basically, she becomes this, like, as I say, this cool aunt whose house in the other world they can run off to when they want to just get away from their parents. It's basically just a slice of life comedy, but it has this, mm-hmm. this strangely authentic mythology to it, despite how unseriously it takes it. Like,
I don't know if you, like, are familiar with, like, Bridge to Terabithia or something, but it's very weird to, like, have Bridge to Terabithia, but except like this magical fake kingdom treehouse. It's just like a snake lady in the woods. So I don't know. It does sound. I've been very fascinated lately about how, like, human ability to extract meaning from noise, and how that's, like, the basis of every. Spaces of culture. Like, I was talking to one of my coworkers, and she was like, every time this person walks in, this song plays. And I'm just like, well, actually, your brain is only remembering the times when they walk in and the song plays, and you're over-indexing those bases versus all the times that this person walks in and this song doesn't play. And she's like, no, I think there's, like, I think Spotify knows. I think there's a connection. And it's just like, okay, that religion 101, theology 101 right there. It's just like, oh no, I think that there's, you know, something invisible behind the scenes. It's making everything.
Yeah,
line up.
That's definitely, there's, like, every chapter is called a mystery, so it's like we're on mystery 76. I do like how it's just like all these little small things which aren't explained, and in some cases it's, oh yeah, this exists because of this and because of that. And it has this idea in it as well, like, inheritance isn't something which is, like, just blood. It's cultural, and it's community, and it's knowledge, and, like, how these tales are passed down through a community can be as much of a legacy as a blood one. At the same time, it's just doing very silly things, because this show has a character designer whose 90% of their work has been on Konosuba. And so if you know how Konosuba designs its women, that's how this show designs its women.
Blobby girls.
Yeah, it's one of the few occasions where I've seen a show be more explicit than the manga. It's like when she first appears, it's the classic strategically well-placed hair. I'm watching the first episode of the show, and it's just like, there be nipples. And I guess we have complained many of times about anime's distinct terror at ever showing especially a male nipple, never the male nipple, but equally nary a female nipple either. But the fact that it's just like, nah, the original doesn't show this at all, I just want to do it. And it's just like,
this cake's for cake, boss.
Yeah.
Just for me.
Yeah. And it's like, does this add anything to it? No, it's just does it change the story? Are they actually really making her more sexy by doing this? No, not particularly. Like, one of the first things which happens in the episode is they steal a bra from one of their neighbors for Dara, and then one of the kids gets a friend to make a six-armed costume, so she has a shrine maiden costume to wear. It just has a very good relationship between its core cast. It's just fun hanging out with them, and it is mostly just hanging out with them, and that's what is good about it. It's just it is slice of life with its supernatural stuff mostly sort of put to one side. I probably enjoyed it more than I did Licorice Rico, despite it being fairly basically animated. This season has a lot of very wonderful looking shows, some
yeah,
which are
we'll
downright jaw-dropping. And indeed, yes, we will be talking about
one. We'll be talking about one that's much worse than the show you're talking about, though, too. So it balances out.
Well, like, one of the things you always hear in the discourse is, oh, this anime has not properly adapted this manga's visuals. Like, it's a fidelity downgrade, so on and so forth. And that is obviously complete and utter bullshit most of the time, because you're obviously losing fidelity because you cannot animate every line. But what you're gaining is you're gaining voice acting, you're gaining movement, you're gaining color. And as long as a show makes use of those things, it can still make those characters vivid in different ways than the manuscript did. And I think Dara-san does succeed in that. It does feel like a community of characters who have believable relationships with each other, and the way it tells its mythology feels like it's something which was incrementally built and which did not sort of crystallize in a flash of a writer's pen, but something where there's a catalyst and then all these things sort of flow out from it, and how it created the little traditions of this local area is quite fun to find out. It's one of those things where I'm not sure I can recommend it to most people, because this is definitely not a...
Has it got titty?
Yeah. Well, it's just, do not watch
it. Don't watch with your mom.
I was going to say, don't watch with your partner show. It's like, that's the first hurdle any anime has to pass. I've recently returned to social media, for better or for worse, and there was a thread on Blue Sky recently where someone was basically saying, anime discourse has barely changed in the past 15 years. Like, a lot of the site and a lot of the video long form things just treat it like enthusiast media. There's still like the sense that you're talking to the people who already like it. There's no sort of treating it just as an art form. And I think part of the problem of that is that we do have to explain why Snake Lady has her titties out, and that is an uncomfortable conversation. You could just go skip to episode 2, you'll be fine, just ignore what happens, but you can't ignore it because it's there.
Hurry. Yeah.
Yeah. Why are you telling me to skip episode 1? And it is frustrating at times. I think this is a good story, and I think it's a good cast, and it's a fun cast to be around, but fan service got to do what fan service got to do. And I think that probably drove off more people than it would attract. Maybe that's just me, but maybe
I mean, if I had a dollar for everyone who doesn't watch who won't watch Dan to Dan because they put an attempted rape in the first episode. But then again, I'm going to talk about a show where like there's an attempted rape every episode. It's like Christmas every day. I don't know. So it's really weird. Like, when people don't really. It feels like anime doesn't want to be aware of like how people have like the 3-episode rule or something of like, you should put your best foot forward. We were talking about that for a while with like Sigur Drifa and other shows where they have these like movie first episodes that really like pull out all the stops, have a high budget, keep the fan service to a minimum. And I feel like that tide has rose and then receded a little bit, because I do feel like I'm seeing a lot of shows, they're just like, you're gonna have to sit down and watch all of me to see what I got going on. I don't know.
I do think that is something where it happens when you have a show which is perceived to be a prestige show. It doesn't happen for a show which is perceived to be kind of like an anime market only show, if that makes sense. Yeah. Daira-san is never
for
pulling
fans in of the genre.
Yeah. Yes. It's never pulling in anyone from outside. It's the fact that I've managed to get Jeff to pick up the manga is enough for me, because I don't think I'll get anyone else to pick up the show, or it's not beautiful in the way other shows are, and it's not tasteful in the way other shows are, because that's it has that we were discussing pickled onions, and that they are very tasty, but they make your breath stink. And this is kind of a pickled onion show, in that it's very enjoyable, very tasty, but I think when you tell people you like it, it's probably the cultural equivalent of a big breath of pickled onion smell.
God, I can't think of a trans. I mean, there are multiple transitions I let pass by because I wanted you to say your piece, and now I'm at an utter dead end, and my martini is empty, so it's even worse.
Tell me, Ben, about a show which sounded to me like it might be a good idea, but in fact turned out to be a very bad idea, and how that maybe
it's
maybe when I'm saying the culture around anime hasn't changed in the past 10-15 years, that maybe when a show comes along which is actually based on a work which is even older than that, you maybe realize that actually maybe it has changed, and maybe it's changed for the good.
That's not a bad point. I also would like to point out, like, when you talked about how adaptations that like add to the original, that's deals with another show. So I'm watching two pieces of historical fiction. I'm watching Jadugar, A Witch in Mongolia, from Science Saru, and I'm also watching Red River. From I can't be fucked to look up the studio name because it's not very good. These are both Jadugar is just a straight work of historical fiction. It follows a Persian slave from Tus who ends up moving through the inner circles of the Mongol court at the beginning of the 13th century, and the 13th century AD, which I have to clarify because Red River is about a girl who gets isekai'd back to the 13th century BC, and the Hittite court of Sopalima the First, right on the cusp of the height of the Hittite Empire, and she becomes involved in the machinations between the evil queen and the princes she hopes to displace. And I remember reading early on with Jadagar that people had mixed feelings about how a lot of the manga takes place in this kind of sketchy, dreamlike space. Someone was lamenting the fact that they have to add backgrounds to every scene, and that a lot of the scenes in Jadagar take place in this like blank, dreamlike void that is only occasionally has like fleshed out details. But I do think that they've adapted wonderfully, and that so many scenes just take place under this trackless sky, like the religion, as far as we can say that Mongols and the steppe peoples of Central Asia had a religion. Their god was the sky god, and granted, like Zeus is a sky god, and Jupiter's a sky god, and all that. But you can really see like this just endless rolling steps and the sky, and the degree to which Jadagar situates itself as a show that is interested in the experiences of being a slave to some of the most powerful people on the planet. And does that make you powerful? Does that make you like an abject victim? The way it's interested in religious beliefs, and specifically conflicting religious beliefs, the way it's interested in how power is expressed differently between the men and the women, and the free women and the enslaved women, and the free men and the enslaved men. It's a show that is so interested in how it feels to be at this point in time. I think I gestured towards it being the Wolf Hall of anime, and then like stoned after work, I said something about how it's also like the Green Knight of anime, because it has this like profound belief in spirituality and in like realizing people's experiences of fantastical events and how they understand these as supernatural, kind of like what you were saying with your show. Like, we see a guy who's like a powerful shaman who can shapeshift, and we watch him do his religious ritual, and you complained, I think, that they actually do like the whole like magic thing, and you just wanted to see the ritual in full and not really have the kind of supernatural chrome glued onto it.
Like,
it's just for the dum-dums, like I said. It's for the people who don't believe that religion is real.
Because, like, that was him, the way he moved, what was being implied, as you were saying, like, how we pick up signal from noise, and how, like, the wind's sort of, like, blowing across the trees, and the sun setting, and, like, how all these things could just be natural phenomena, but they can be imbued with great meaning. And I think the animation was beautiful enough and evocative enough that I didn't need it to make that leap for me. I was already making it, but...
Yeah, but you're a sensitive soul, and other people
aren't. But also, like, maybe that's something which is more difficult to do on the page. Like, maybe the stuff you're talking about with the original manga, like conveying a dance is more difficult when you don't have motion. It's simple as that.
No, I agree.
There are some things.
We don't have music or chanting or anything too, yeah.
Like, there are some things where animation just has an advantage over a drawn media. It's not to say either medium is better than the other. They just have strength.
Yeah.
And when one of those mediums takes that strength and excels at it, then I think it should just be left at that. Whereas I feel like this was maybe vestiges of its drawn form, where he has this vision quest. I can imagine on a page that being beautiful in its own way. Those drawings are doing what the environment and his dancing can't do on the page.
Yeah. I just appreciate it with that scene with the end of the Merkits and this like Mongol Turkic interfaction rivalry. And that's another thing. And I don't want to go into it too much because I'll kill myself having to find like links for everything I'm saying. But this like this melting pot of Uyghur Turks and Oghuz Turks and Mongols and Persians and Sogdiani and Chinese and Khitan and like this melting pot, but just watching like the degree to which like a profound religious experience can be created from just physically exhausting oneself or drinking a great amount of water or starving oneself, and the way that they don't focus on what would happen, they focus on what can happen. And just like, I agree, I found that scene, I teared up watching this guy just work himself into a frenzy with this chanting. And that is how a lot of shamans do it, is they push themselves physically beyond anything we can possibly imagine. When you're passing out after having danced and chanted for 6 hours straight, you do see God. And is it more real than anything else? I don't know, but I really enjoyed that they're fully credulous. Like, no one's beliefs are revealed to be false or foolish or pathetic. There's never this like Wolfgang Petersen Troy like attempt to deflate the experiences here. And that's what makes Yadagar so special. Mm-hmm. And it's something like, it's really unlucky that Red River comes out the same, because I'd probably be more indulgent. There are things I like about Red River. I like that because she comes from modern times, Yuri knows what iron looks like, and that's a superpower in the Bronze Age, is like knowing about iron. And I like the idea that she's supposed to be this like second coming of Ishtar, and like there's all these things that we think of as like basic traits of civilization that she just takes for granted. She can ride a horse, something that's very unusual. She understands mercy, which I don't know if that, I don't know how historically, I mean, they depict
mercy
like,
was,
they
depict invented in the 11th right. century BC.
They depict Hittite society as very draconian. The punishment for everything is death. Except being an evil queen who just poisons people unceasingly and sends people to kidnap the protagonist of the anime unceasingly. And the idea that she has this idea of justice that is very embryonic, and the idea that most of the difficulties in Red River come from the fact that Yuri, who's associated with Princess Kail, who is just a good boy, like he's just an honorable guy, like obviously the broken state of the Hittite court would be fixed if his father would hurry up and kick the bucket, and then he can rule and just fix everything. And but like the idea that like no one can accuse the queen because no one of higher standing, which is only the king himself, wants to accuse her, and that's like, I like that. But in practice, it is a show where at least once an episode, Yuri is kidnapped, or someone attempts to murder her, or someone attempts to rape her. And the degree to which like I come in, I'm like, okay, this is, I'm going to be nice to Red River.
But nay.
My weekend with my job is from Sunday to Tuesday. And on Saturday I watched Yadagar, and on Tuesday I've had a great weekend, and I'm like, I'm ready to be nice to Red River. And I always fail, and I always end up ranting in the Slack of like, oh my God, they gave one of the other princes the rape poison. The only person, the queen who controls all the poisons, she gave him a rape poison, and now he like tried to rape her, and then like she punched him in the stomach. It's getting really funny how everyone gets like kneed or punched in the stomach to barf out the poison, and then they're fine. They're like, oh, I don't know what came over me. It's so like rudimentary shoujo, and the setting is very exciting, but it is not interested beyond these like beyond reifying how cool it is to have modern technologies like iron and horseback riding and justice. It's not really interested in the experience of living in the Hittite court. Now, it's really hopeful it would be. And also, it's ugly. It's like there's so many battles, and they are all just like 2016 Berserk, like PS2 models, just kind of cycling. And the action is so murky that everyone just like wears color coordinated outfits. You know, so it's like a football game or something. It's just, it's so weird to like have two works of historical fiction at the same time. And one is just, it's just so brilliant and so curious about like, what is different about this time than our time? And the other is just like, wouldn't it be great to be a queen and also to know where history is going to head?
It does really sound like, sadly, that when I was like, and it's like, oh, Ben, we're getting a historic isekai, and the bit which I seems to be ringing out the truest is, Ben, I made you watch an isekai. I'm sorry.
Also, just like, she gets isekai'd by like creepy witch hands pulling her through a puddle, and then she escapes, and then she's in the bath, and creepy witch hands pull her in the bath. It's just like, it's so weird. Like, proto isekai are fascinating to me. Mm. But this one sucks. It sucks. I'm not having a good time. Part of the reason I'm talking about it now is so that I don't just like consume 10 minutes of poor Duncan's editing time, like ranting about it in the end of season episode, because I'm having such a bad time. It's the worst thing I'm watching. Mm. By a long shot, and Jadagar is the best thing I'm watching by a long shot. It is the most Ben.
That
thing.
Is a harsh light.
Yeah, it's the most Ben anime since the first Girls in Panzer series. That I'm just like, it's just tribal politics and wonderfully historically researched. Like, it's the slave who is part of the household of a very notable scholar in northern Persia ends up being the figure in this extremely complex court drama that comes to a head at the end of the 2030s. And I just love it. I love that we never see Genghis Khan's face. He's always this kind of like character wreathed in light. And someone was talking about how like Tolui also has the light. None of the other suns have the light, but yeah. Tolui is always shown as like a ray of light or a bursting star or a sun. And the way that they use the way that these rulers would depict themselves to kind of communicate tropes about like what's going on and who has what power. Not enough people are watching Jadagar. I don't care how many people are watching Jadagar. Not enough people are watching it.
I'm glad to say both it and my favorite show of this season both actually seem to be doing remarkably well. Both Sayonara Lara and Jagadar both seem to have found their audience, which I'm very happy about. Mm-hmm. And it's sad that Red River is an artifact of its time, sort of. Like, I feel like it was one of those things where, because it's an early work in a genre, like it didn't have the confidence to really be subtle. You had to be bold. And I think often early works are bold, but they are not refined just by their very early nature.
And I hate to suggest this, but also being written in a pre-internet world where like doing research for your historical drama was sending someone to the library to read an encyclopedia about the Hittite Empire is probably different from the incredible amount of detail that Jadagar has. Just absolutely, like, there's some liberties they take, especially like smoking hashish and like certain types of like military gear and stuff. But the degree to which like me as someone who knows a decent amount about the Mongols is just bowled over by like what they show. It's just the technology of researching a historical setting has advanced immeasurably in the last 50 years too.
We were talking earlier about like how many of the promises of the early internet have faded, like this access of knowledge, and in his maybe a weird way where some of the promises have held up, and some of that's being slowly eroded as the internet is filled with slop. I imagine the ability to research something is getting tougher and tougher. Like, you're having to be incredulous about everything. Yeah. The very first thing you presented on the world's main access to information is frequently wrong.
Yeah,
I'm going to coin the horrific but appropriate phrase "slop hole."
God, never mind. That's our episode. Slop hole 23.
Yeah, the to describe a plot hole which is created by the author believing AI slop. It's going to happen. Like, someone's going to write a book, and it's just going to be like, I believe this, and this was true. And it's going to be like, no, the entire foundation of your thing was built on something which some AI spat out and you took for granted. I do think, like, to a degree, scholarship has always been, for anyone in any form, whether it be artistic or it be historic or mathematic, there's always been that the number one principle is you work on the principle that something is wrong until proven right. The meticulousness that something like Jagadar goes to create something which is mostly right is laudable.
I mean, it's hard for me to think of a work of pre-modern fiction that is more well-researched by my lights. And it's interesting because you did say, like, you know, assume wrong until proven right, and that's the historian's trait, and we're all going to have to turn into historians. We're gonna read someone being like, there were a million soldiers on this medieval battlefield, and you're like, I'm gonna look at some other sources first. It's hard to jump from this to Crest of the Stars. I'm rewatching that with a friend. I really like this show. I think it bears all the signs, speaking of slop, of being based on sci-fi novels that have actually thought about stuff. It's perspective following this young boy whose father, the ruler of a planet, submits to this grand benevolent space elf empire that is soon under attack by the last remaining human empires, who all hate the elves for being perfect and beautiful and living 300 years and not desiring rule, just desiring commerce and trade, and how he falls in with this runaway princess from the empire in the middle of the war, and they fall in love, and it's space battles, and then it's kind of on the run on a planet, and then it's kind of a spy thriller. I don't have a lot to say, but I do think it's just a good time. It's a really good story that cares about its characters and cares about the relationships. You don't need to talk about this at all. I'm not feeling it.
Okay.
it's self-evidently good. The space combat is very interesting. That everything takes place in these like bubbles of reality in a 2D like hyperspace, and so all the battles are conducted with drones. Them shooting each other, and so the battles are good. The two kids are both like, he's like nice but has kind of a dry sense of humor, and the elf princess is very, very plucky, very fearless, and has a curiosity that's mitigated by the insecurity of being a preteen. It's just a good relationship that is set against a blossoming backdrop of intergalactic war. And the show, as it goes from Crest to Banner, becomes more about these two people coming of age in like what the Ob, the Empire, like everyone's Ob. If you're ruled by the Ob, you're Ob, but there are also ethnic Ob who are these former genetically engineered slaves that have like freed themselves and become like what they think of as the future of humanity. The Ob say this is going to be like, we're doing humanity a favor. This will be the last war. After we rule, we will leave everyone alone, but there will be no war. There will be no hatred or discrimination. We will just create a galaxy of peace. And they're the good guys, as opposed to that being like, oh, that sounds kind of creepy. Like they are going to fix humanity. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about with our like futuristic urban societies, is that there will be no ethnic differences. Everyone is Ob, even if you are, whether you are an Ob subject or, you know, a 11th generation Ob royalty, we are all the same. I have these days when I watch a show that's an anime that's based on a novel, I always kind of like, oh, someone thought more about this setting than the average person.
But not a light novel. A novel. Yeah. Not a light novel.
Yeah. Not a light novel, not a manga. This is a novel written by a guy who probably read a lot of sci-fi in the late 80s and early 90s before writing these books. And the adaptation comes actually quite short after the anime adaptation. These are mid-90s, and Crest of the Stars is the end of the 90s. And like Lafiel, the space princess, has this sort of thing where the Ob, just when you want to have a kid, you combine your genetics however you want, and that's your kid, and you can clone yourself, you can mix your genes with your best friend, you can just run a randomizer over the genes.
Roll
and
a
her father her father, the crown prince, has always joked that he blended his genes with their pet cat's genes, and that's who, but she has this anxiety that like there's like a still a cultural value of like, are you a child of love? Were your parents' genes mixed with the genes of the person they love? Like, are you as close to these people get to a biological child? And she has this kind of insecurity about it, and this desire to have her existence be something more intentionally made. And she's talking with this bog standard human boy who, like, of course my parents of course I have genes from both of my parents. That's how it works. And so it's kind of encountering this alien society and these evolving cultural values against this backdrop of war and rising conflict.
The stuff you're talking about, their parentage, is it Brave New World, the Huxley one, where there's this idea of this almost novelty in finding someone who is born naturally? Like, mm-hmm. there's this whole fuss around, oh yeah, you, unlike everyone else who's been perfectly genetically engineered, he was born, and that is a negative thing. Whereas in Crest/Band of the Stars, that is actually seen as a positive thing. And I wonder if, because obviously Brave New World is famously a dystopian book, and if like part of Banner slash Crest was doing is reacting to that idea and saying like, yeah, that we're going to take an optimistic view on this future society where you could mm-hmm. just mix people together, but instead of that devaluing the connections people build, and it actually reinforces is their worth. That even though it does become sort of like an anxiety and maybe a slight prejudice within society, that love still has value in a society where you can just reproduce without it, where you can just go have a kid.
It's one of the interesting dynamics, because on the one hand, Crest and Banner of the Stars is this fantasy of just like the big empire who is unstoppable and is going to win. Like, it feels fairly foregone quite early in the show that the Ob are going to win. Like, this alliance of four human empires, they're backwards, they're deceitful, they're corrupt, they use lying propaganda. So there's this kind of power fantasy of, it's Star Wars, but the Empire is in the right, and the rebels are a bunch of like evil sex perverts, religious fanatic sex perverts that deserve to be crushed, and like, it will be good when the Ob rule all of us. But also, as the show goes on, in addition to Lafiel and Jinto, the two young lovers who end up joining rejoining the military and fighting on a ship during the war, like, the main cast is this almost Legend of Galactic Heroes procession of eccentric Ob admirals, and all of them have their kind of...
Okay, no, you should have led with that, Ben, because I'm intrigued now. Like,
I'll send you a picture of my favorite. She's got the big, thick side braid, which is one of my favorite detail, like, character design elements, and she, like, gets offended if anyone ever suggests that she's not going to win instantly. She's very, like, haughty, and there's, like, one guy who... Like, it's like, oh, but these advisors, they're not fit to take care of cats. And like his adjutant's like, sir, that's pretty harsh. He's like, you're right. They are fit to take care of cats. And that's just like there's all these like, and so that we have this Borg like threat of this just like these hyper advanced genetically engineered aliens that are going to rule over society. But then it ends up that they're all fucking weirdos, and they all just kind of like do their own thing. And there's actually more diversity in the matrix of this like assimilationist empire than there is in the strict moralistic religious fundamentalist human empires.
That's a lot like Banks's culture, to be honest.
It's very culture-like, especially their aversion to ruling planets. Like, they have no – their interest in ruling planets is purely just to control the trade and to make sure there's freedom of movement throughout the stars. Mm-hmm. I think it's similarly that, like, the outsiders see the Ob as this, like, terrifying, like, homogenous, like, army of emotionless, ageless elves. And in fact, it's a bunch of weirdos all pursuing their, like, super autistic hobbies. Yeah. And that's probably why I like it. I like the Banks books a lot, so, yeah.
Like, obviously, one element of the Banks books a lot of people have grabbed onto in these current times is its use of AI. Is that at all a plot element, or is it more fantasy in space, or is it...
It's complicated. They have a third eye inside their head that allows them to perceive spatial conformities, and so, like, a lot of their computer elements is, like, hooking up... Like, they have these tiaras that, like, interface with their third eye, so they're able to, like... There's very little, like, actual computer stuff. Like, computers are... There's this very funny scene near the end of... near the middle of Crest of the Stars, where Lafiel's trying to hack a database, and it's just, like, every time she gets for, like... a step further. It's just like, you do not have the right to access this data. And like, it's just very like typical computers. But there is this sense that they have this kind of mind machine interface that's exceptional, that allows them to have this mastery of space and this idea of it's very transhuman. And I like that despite being transhuman, these are slaves, like slaves of a distant colony who cut themselves off from their mother colony and then eventually decided to form a state so that they could go back and conquer their mother colony so that their mother colony would never come for them. And that's the beginning of the Ob Empire, is just making, like, spreading peace throughout the galaxy to make it safe for these, like, deviant humans.
No one should ever end up like we did. That's a very, like, giving an empire quite a character almost, like, going back to prevent its trauma ever reoccurring. Like,
they talk about it as this, like, they were forced to have a political consciousness because of this threat to their existence, and the fact that they were not automatically seen as human forced them to have... It is a lot like the culture in that this, like, specific catalyst of injustice created this, like, relatively utopian infinite empire. I don't know. I like it a lot. I hope we're gonna watch Gankutsuo next after we finish Crest of the Stars. I hope. I'll make it so. But I hope to keep watching Banner of the Stars, because it is, even at its slowest points, the next two seasons are just wacky admirals, and they're, like, eccentric ideas about space combat, and the space combat itself is pretty good with, like I said, all these, like, these drone-like mines. You have defensive drones and offensive drones, and
I think you've done, see Ben, you were a bit down on talking about this, but I think you've done a good enough job of making me interested to watch it.
It's hard to describe, because it is just like good sci-fi, and I appreciate you bringing up Ian Banks, because it is just kind of like, it's a bit more optimistic. Like, there's this awful war that's going to, like, consume every part of humanity that has spread out massively across the stars. But, like I said, there's this general sense that, like, the good guys are going to win. This is not a struggle against a boot heel, like, clamping down on the throat of humanity. Like, some part of us has figured out the right way to live, and they're going to conquer the rest of us for their own good, and there are parts of that are very uncomfortable, especially given, like, geopolitical events of the past several months. But it's nice to watch a show where the good guys are the strong ones sometimes, where not everybody is a helpless slave at the mercy of a mercurial court of nomads with confusing beliefs and terrifying power.
Who is the real monster there? I would suggest the girl with starry eyes. might end up not to be as innocent as her smile.
Nah. But what about the gray, the sickly gray eminence who smiles behind her hands when she poisons the young air? Anyway. Okay, well, let's go ahead and call it there. Tune in next time. Next month, we'll be talking about the end of the season. You'll probably hear me talking a little bit more about Jadagar, but I hope not too much, because I hope we're going to get another season of it. Maybe 18 seasons of it.
I have horrible news. Like, there's not much left after they've adapted at the rate they're going.
I mean, I'm willing to wait some years for it. I'm willing to wait. I just want more. And I want people to copy this. I want this to, like... to rattle Apothecary Diaries cage and make them a bit more historically nerdy for me personally. But in the meantime, rate and subscribe to us on the podcast platform of your choice. Find us on Blue Sky Keyframes Podcast. We're posting more there nowadays. Find us on Facebook. Search for Keyframes Pod. I just throw up the episodes there. You can comment if you like. I'll always respond. Email us questions, keyframespodcast@gmail.com. Tell me how much you like Jadagar. And most of all, tell a friend.
Tell a friend who has become a nomad, a digital nomad, roaming cyberspace, raiding domains and looting their knowledge and bringing it back their little cyber nomad home and squirreling it away. You should tell them, probably keep an eye out on their queen, because she might be plotting.
Tell a friend who's getting into drugs or cybernetics.
Tell them it's probably not a good idea.
All right, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye. What a weird one. I say that every time, but woof.